Coming up is the Wednesday morning radio zine. This is KBOO Portland.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Oh, wait. Thank you.
Thank you for contributing to KBOO's membership drive. It was a success, and we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your care.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. Coming right up at 9. It's now 9:01. We have political perspectives today. Jimmy Tardy, Brian Wilson, and Mike Hasty talk with Larry Colburn, an Army veteran who, while serving as a helicopter gunner in the Vietnam War, intervened in the My Lai massacre in 1968. At 10 o'clock, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10 o'clock, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter speaks with Gyathra Rampasad, author of the memoir Shadows in the Sun, Healing from Depression and Finding the Light Within. And as you just heard, we thank you so much, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent membership drive. And if you're not a member yet, you can become one quickly by going to kboo.fm and click where it says Donate Today. We have a couple of sad announcements about the loss of two great women today. First, writer Maya Angelou died at her home in Winston-Salem, North Carolina today. She was 86 years old. She was a novelist, actress, professor, singer, dancer, and activist. She is perhaps best known for her book, I Know Why, The Caged Bird Sings. And also in Portland, musician Janice Scroggins has died. She reportedly suffered a heart attack. She was 58. Janice Scroggins came to Portland in the late 70s and was well known for playing piano with many local musicians. She was also a composer and a widely loved person for her compassion and kindness to all. We will miss her terribly, and we mourn the loss of both of these great women. Now we're just going to go on to a discussion about the My Lai massacre in 1968. Thanks for tuning in today.
Hugh Thompson was a pilot, just like many more, fighting for old glory on a far-off foreign shore. He was on a lethal mission, only one of many, following his orders to kill the enemy, to kill the enemy. He flew low above the village, searching for the foe. When he saw a wounded child on the path below, he thought this to be a sure sign that the enemy was near. So he radioed for backup, and more choppers did appear. More choppers did appear.
Thanks for joining us today. I'm Jimmy Tardy. I'm joined by Brian Wilson and Mike Hasty, and we have Mr. Larry Colburn on the phone from Atlanta, Georgia. Mr. Colburn was involved in the My Lai incident on March 16th, 1968. He was one of the door gunners in Hugh Thompson's helicopter. The helicopter that was piloted by Mr. Thompson, those three men, Mr. Andriotta, Mr. Colburn, and Mr. Thompson, were the crew of this helicopter, which intervened in the massacre by United States troops upon Vietnamese civilians The story has been widely reported over the years, and a lot of people would say that this incident began the end of the Vietnam War. We want to talk today with Mr. Colburn about that incident, about his experience. We're going to talk about Mr. Thompson. We're going to talk about experiences of Vietnam veterans in villages, and we're going to talk about the power of one person to stop incidents such as these and to potentially even bring an end to a war. Shortly after Mr. Thompson's death, Mr. Colburn spoke with Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman about My Lai. We'll go to part of that interview now, which helps set the scene.
Early in the morning, we were one of the first American units on station, ahead of the Americans that would be inserted on the ground. And it started out as a routine air support and reconnaissance mission. But as the day progressed, we noticed obviously that we weren't receiving any fire. Our job was to fly low level and try to entice people into giving up their positions by firing on us. And that wasn't happening. We saw people leaving the village. It was a Saturday morning, so it wasn't uncommon for the people to go to market on Saturday morning. So we thought it was good that these women and children and elderly people were leaving the area. And as we progressed around the perimeter of the area that the troops were being inserted into, we found nothing as far as resistance. At some point, we had to go refuel, and it was so quiet that morning that we didn't even call a backup team to cover us while we were refueling. And then when we came back from refueling, we started finding the same people that were leaving the area on the road out of the village were now dead on the road and in the ditches. And Mr. Thompson tried to piece together different scenarios. He knew it wasn't artillery because that had happened earlier in the morning. There were other gunships on station, but they weren't firing on the villagers. Finally, after marking a few bodies with smoke for medical assistance, we witnessed a captain approach a wounded woman and walked up to her and kicked her with his foot, stepped back, and blew her away. Then we realized what was going on and exactly who was doing the killing. Mr. Thompson landed by the ditch where there were probably 150, 200 people dead or dying. There was an American soldier standing there. We actually landed the aircraft because the communication was so bad. He physically got out of the aircraft, went over and spoke to the soldier and explained to him these were obviously civilians. There were no weapons captured. There were no draft age males. These are civilians. We need to help them out. And the soldier agreed and said he'd help them out. And as we lifted off again, we heard automatic weapons fire, and he was firing into the ditch again. So at that point, Glenn Andriotta spotted an earthen type bunker with some faces peering out of it. And there was an approaching squad of Americans, and Mr. Thompson decided, and we all decided, that if we didn't do something within the next 30 seconds, these people would die. So he landed the aircraft in between the advancing American troops and the people in the bunker, went over and spoke to a lieutenant and told him, or asked him, how we could get these people out of the bunker. They were obviously civilians. And the lieutenant replied he'd get them out with hand grenades. Mr. Thompson, who was outranked by this lieutenant, actually gave the lieutenant an order, told him to keep his people in place. He had a better idea. And I think he told him, if you fire on these people when I'm getting them out of the bunker, my people will fire on you. So he went over to the bunker himself and coaxed the villagers out, and we thought there were two or three. There were 9 or 10. And we were in a small three-place helicopter, and all three seats were occupied, so we had to call down a gunship and use it as a medevac to remove these people from the area, take them down the road.
So, Larry, when you got out of the helicopter, what was the scene, and how was it affecting you viscerally or deeply within yourself?
That time when we landed because Glenn had spotted some people hiding in an earthen-tight bunker, and there was a squad of American troops headed in that direction. Because of what we'd seen earlier in the day, we concluded that these people had, you know, a very short time to live, because that's what had been happening all day, or all morning. So Hugh decided he wasn't having any of it, so he landed the aircraft in between the bunker and the people approaching the bunker, the American troops approaching the bunker. Got out of the aircraft and told, Glenn and I got out and pulled our 60s off the bungee cords and took a length of ammunition with us and just protected the aircraft. Mr. Thompson said, I'm going to go talk to this lieutenant. So he walked off about 30, 40 meters away and confronted the lieutenant that was approaching the bunker. What was said, I don't know. I was too far away. The aircraft was at flight idle. We had flight helmets on. But I could see they were nose-to-nose in a heated discussion. Mr. Thompson walked back to the aircraft, told Glenn and myself to huddle up, and he said, if these people fire on me or on these people when I'm trying to get them out of the bunker, I'm going to go over there and get them out myself, shoot them. He turned and walked toward the bunker, and Glenn and I looked at the approaching American soldiers. They'd stopped. I think one of the reasons they stopped, it was smart of Hugh to leave the aircraft at flight idle, because how close do you want to come to a tail rotor or a rotor blade?
Right.
On uneven terrain. So they kind of stayed on the other side of the aircraft, and we just watched them while Hugh went and got the people out of the bunker.
And did any of the U.S. soldiers shout at you, scream at you, make any gestures towards you?
No. They were beginning to take their rucksacks off and take a break, I guess. I remember looking at one fella, and I raised an open palm to him and waved to him. He waved back to me. And at that moment, I knew he was going to pull it off. They weren't in a combative posture or anything like that. They looked like they were ready to sit down and take a break. So they stayed where they were, and a couple of them sat down, and Thompson called in a gunship and got those people out of there.
Mm-hmm. Then what happened?
Well, immediately after that, I think that's when we went back to the ditch and Glenn got the little boy out of the ditch.
Mm-hmm. And what did you see in that ditch, and how was it affecting you?
What we saw in the ditch were female, mostly female, and children in the ditch. They'd probably fired at least two or three volleys into the ditch. There were probably between 150 and 200 people, my guess. It was hard to determine because the bodies were stacked on top of one another. Some of the people were bleeding out. They weren't dead yet. Some people were trying to crawl out of the ditch. But Glenn had a visual on this little boy, so Hugh landed the aircraft and Glenn immediately jumped out. The left side of the aircraft was closest to the ditch, so by the time I came around, Glenn was already in the ditch, and I just thought it would be best if I stood at the top of the ditch and covered him while he was doing work down there.
Mm-hmm.
How I felt, I feel shameful even today, but at that point, I'd kind of shut down. It wasn't a luxury that I could take part in
right
then. You kind of put all that on the back burner and just do what you have to do. There's no time for dialogue or emotion. I just kind of shut down emotionally, and we did what we had to do.
And was there any more shooting after that by U.S.? Or did that kind of stop all the shooting?
By noon, it was pretty much finished.
Uh-huh. And I know there were several other hamlets that were attacked the same day.
Yeah, a hamlet not too far away. I think there were 90 or 100 people killed there. After we picked up the boy from the ditch to
carry him to a little hospital orphanage in Quangai. We dropped him off. We were only gone 15 minutes or so, and then we came back on station. The same day, Hugh went up to the command bunker there in Chulai, where Colonel Henderson stayed or worked. He told me to come with him. Or actually, he asked me if I'd come with him and report to the colonel what we'd seen that morning, so that's what we did. We thought that giving this information up the chain of command is what we were supposed to do.
Right. Now, I understand that Hugh Thompson was 24 at the time?
Yes.
And how old were you?
I was 18.
And Andriotta?
20.
20. What a young person to experience all this, right? And, of course, a lot of massacres were happening, as we now know, around the countryside. Little did we know at the time. Little did I know what was going on. Mike?
Well, I just want to say that a couple of things. I was in the Central Highlands in Onkay. I was a medic, and I was there when Callie was found guilty, and I remember an APC drove up to our aid station. On the front of the APC, the crew had painted in white large letters that said, "Kill a Gook for Callie." And I remember I went and got my camera and took a photograph of it, because I didn't really follow the massacre and didn't really have that much knowledge of what happened when I was there. I got to Vietnam, and like I say, in 70, 71, so I was seeing the rapid disintegration of American involvement in Vietnam. I was seeing the homicides, the suicides, the rampant heroin addiction, shootouts, accidents, racial violence. And, we'd get hit every once in a while, but it just seemed like I was focused on, a lot of things that were just going on within my own unit. I made a trip back to Vietnam in 1994, so I was at the My Lai massacre site, and I saw that ditch, and I photographed it, and I know at the time that what was really prevalent inside of me was, I think, one word, not one word, but shame. There was four of us, the four veterans went in to the site. I had two cameras, and I was photographing things as fast as I could. So we went into the War Crimes Museum. We walked around the area, and I spent a fair amount of time, at that particular ditch taking photographs. And then the other three went into a building where there was tables and white tablecloths and a bust of Ho Chi Minh, and there was a book that people could sign. And they went in there, and I stayed outside and continued to take photographs, because there's a lot of other monuments there. I was photographing, and then all of a sudden a tour bus drove up, and out came about 50 Vietnamese. And I was really struck. It affected me when all of this group of people were looking up at the large monument where the man's got his fist up in the air, and there's another person holding a dead child. So that's when I was feeling all of this, I guess, shame. And so I finished taking my photographs, and then I wanted to join the other three in the building. And I had my head down, and all of a sudden, just as I was getting ready to walk back to to where the other three were gathered in the building, I had my head down and I was just trying to slither off. And all of a sudden, this Vietnamese man that was on the bus came up to me, and he looked like he was of the age to have been involved in the war. Anyway, he walked up to me and stuck his hand out and shook my hand. And he said something very kind to me in Vietnamese. Obviously, I didn't understand the words, but it was his facial expression that really said it all for me. And that was a really important moment for me. And so I just wanted to say that to let you know that, there has been a lot of people that have gone back and have gone into the site. It was a very powerful experience for me.
It reminds me of a line. I don't know who wrote it, but it goes, "I looked into the eyes of my enemy and I saw myself."
Yes.
"To kill him would be suicide, to love him, salvation."
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was my biggest revelation when I came back from Vietnam. You know, I wound up in a couple of psychiatric hospitals, and I was admitted to the VA several times for panic attacks. One of the hardest things, why it's hard to get over Vietnam, is that what the United States government does is they take the chess piece called Vietnam and they just move it around the world. And every time the U.S. goes into another third world country and starts bombing it, you know, the Vietnam War is resurrected for me.
Larry, I presume you've been back to My Lai at least once, if not more.
Well, let's see, we went back in 98 with the 60 Minutes crew. We went back in 2001 to be reunited with Bill Ba, the boy from the ditch.
Uh-huh.
Then again in 2008. I went over with Michael Bilton, the author of 4 Hours in My Lai.
Oh, yeah.
The best read if you're interested, and a French film crew.
Uh-huh.
And little advice: don't ever let a French film crew book your flights from the States to Vietnam. Don't do it. I think it was 40 hours one way.
Wow.
I wanted to ask you something. I would like to have you talk a little bit about the cover up. And the minimizing of what happened afterwards and how that affected you, especially someone who was there when it happened.
Well, the cover-up started immediately when Medina called in his body count. He was covering things up. I think he said, I forget the exact number, 25, 28 Viet Cong killed. I think that's what he reported. After we reported to Henderson, and the way I saw Colonel Henderson react, I sort of knew that this was going to end up under the carpet, that no matter what they did, the military wasn't going to really face the music and admit to what happened there that day. Consequently, that's pretty much what happened.
The cover-up actually just kind of continued.
Mm-hmm.
All the senior officers, most of West Point graduates, just were not interested in acknowledging it or reporting it. In fact, I think it was 28 officers in the Peers report that were initially investigated for covering it up, for not acknowledging and reporting it. And even there was a Major Colin Powell, who was in the AmeriCal division, who later became Secretary of State. Even he was involved in a minor way, but he was charged with investigating a letter by Tom Glenn, who was a soldier from the 11th Light Infantry Brigade, which supported the rumored allegations of the massacre, My Lai. And Powell wrote, in direct refutation of this betrayal, is the fact that relations between American soldiers and Vietnamese people are excellent. And then in May 2004, when he was being interviewed by Larry King, he said, I was in a unit that was responsible for My Lai. So he acknowledged it, and at least finally. Are you aware of this 13-year effort that was started by Obama called the Vietnam War Commemoration? It goes from 2012, when it was launched, to 2024 or 5. It's a $5 million a year Pentagon propaganda campaign to legitimize and glamorize the war. And so this interview...
Vietnam War? Yeah. It's hard to keep track of them.
Yes, it is, because we suffer from multiple wars. But it is about the Vietnam War. This interview, you might say, in purposes of Portland's effort, there's a national effort called Full Disclosure, and it's going to be an antidote to the official story that's going to be constantly developing. And so we are going to be doing lots of things about resurrecting the history of the war. And you could say that all the wars that we're involved in are never going to be reported honestly or considered in history in any genuine way. So.
Well, it's, you know how the military works. It's the need-to-know basis.
Right.
Let me ask you this. As far as mental health, a nation's mental health, getting past My Lai, what if we treated it the same way we're treating these accidental drone strikes in Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever they might be, putting a missile on a wedding party or whatever the mistake was? I've heard high-ranking people in the military apologize for what happened and offer the usual compensation to the people directly involved. What if we did that, if we treated My Lai that way, if we were to formally apologize, something that's never happened, and reasonably compensate the people directly involved and the survivors? Would that help us close the book and put My Lai behind us as a nation? It's just an idea.
It's a question. Now, in my case, I was in the Air Force, but I was a ground officer trained at a ranger training at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, even though I was in the Air Force. I had 40 men, and we were protecting air bases. I wasn't really doing ranger work, thank God. I had no interest in it, but that's what we were trained to be. And I had an extra duty. I was to go wherever this lieutenant directed me because we were going to assess the success of bombing missions. And I thought it was a little strange. It wasn't really my duty, but it was during the day. Ostensibly was pretty safe during the day. But what I discovered in 1 week, in fact, the first village I went into, what I witnessed was that this was a fishing village, not defended in any way. And the bombing happened in the morning, like around 10 or 11. And everything in the village was destroyed. And I estimated 120, 130 bodies. Almost all of them women and small children. And that week, I went into four other villages as part of this assignment. And there were somewhere between 700 and 900 dead in that week that I witnessed. And I realized that this was an intentional plan. The Vietnamization was supposedly turning the war over to the Vietnamese, as if they hadn't been in the war all along. But all they wanted was body counts. And
that was the order of the day, right? General Westmoreland. I want bodies.
Right. And so in Vinh Long province, where these villages were, there were about 30 villages on the target list. I only went into five of them. But virtually everybody is killed. If they're not killed initially by the bombs, they're killed by the napalm. I was finished with napalm. And so I was in shock. I was sick. I was throwing up. I was standing over the bodies. Even though it was weird because I wasn't in any combat situation. I was just assessing what had happened 45 minutes earlier. But then I realized when I went to Saigon later that week to look at the 7th Air Force bombing reports, I looked at the bombings in Vinh Long province the week before where I had been, discovered that every village was with a number attached in terms of casualties was considered VC, 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 VC.
Sure, sure.
And so it was very easy to have My Lais from the air all through the war.
Well, it became, in the thick of it, shoot first and ask questions later. And I'm sorry you had to see that. But if there's anything redeeming about talking about My Lai, would it be better to bring us up to date and consider what veterans these days are going through and how we can somehow help them? I try not to stay back there in the past.
But the problem is that the pattern just continues over and over again. So in some ways what we are representing is our history and comparing it with current history and realizing that we're all kind of guinea pigs for geostrategic resources and multinational corporations.
Sure.
And that's the lesson I like to be able to be conveying to the newer vets. I think it's also worthy to say that you three that were on that helicopter, you three were shunned for years. And you were, I remember Mendel Rivers, who was chair of the House Armed Services Committee or something like that, one of those committees. He said that Mr. Thompson should be considered tried for treason. And there were other congressmen that identified the three of you as the three that should have been prosecuted.
Oh, they tried to make him disappear. After Vietnam, all of a sudden, he was transferred from an Aero Scout unit, which was Hugh Thompson and an OH-23 Raven flying low level, with two gunships in tow for support. That all of a sudden changed to Hugh Thompson and an OH-23 Raven and one other pilot and a 23 Raven going out into a place called Dragon Valley. Chulai was receiving some rockets from that area, and they'd send them out there, just two 23s. Hugh crashed, I think, 5 aircraft in as many months. And the last time he crashed, he broke his back, and that got him out of country. Mm-hmm. But it was almost as if they were sending him out
to be killed.
In hopes that he might just disappear.
Yeah.
And beware of an attack. And then the child died by a bullet through her back. And when he looked around for the culprits of the scene, it was a company of men in U.S. military green. U.S. military green. The dead were in the hundreds.
Well, I know that when Callie was convicted, Callie at the time was in Fort Benning, and Georgia's governor at the time was Jimmy Carter, and he instituted something called the American Fighting Man's Day and asked Georgians to drive for a week with their lights on in support of Callie.
Well, if you want to know how I feel about all of that, you know, people calling us traitors and people supporting the people who actually committed the atrocities, first of all, those people showed support for the people that committed the atrocities were misinformed, so you can't really blame them. But if someone wants to, and Hugh felt the same way, and I'm sure Glenn would have too, if you want to call us traitors for what we did, that's perfectly fine. You just run with that. And I'll wear that traitor badge with pride.
Right.
If you want to call me a traitor, come and call me a traitor in my face.
I understand that Andriotta was killed shortly after the My Lai massacre date.
Yeah, he was killed instantly on a mission.
Mm-hmm.
Larry, this is Mike Hastie again. There's one thing I want to read, and I'm sure you know Paul Medlow.
Yes, yeah.
But I was reading Seymour Hersher's book on My Lai 4. Paul made this statement. He says, "I don't even know for sure what a massacre is or an atrocity. That war over there is just a series of massacres every day, one after the other." And it was also interesting when Colonel Orrin Henderson made a statement that's been quoted quite a bit, who was the brigade commander of Charlie Company, and he said here, he says, "Every unit of brigade size has its My Lai hidden somewhere. The only reason they remain unknown was every unit doesn't have a ridden hour." And, you know, when I look at the events that came together that brought this out, you know, I think of three people, and certainly you can add to that list. Obviously, it was Hugh Thompson, and of course, the two of you were on the helicopter. But there was Ron Ridenour, and then there was Ron, the combat photographer,
Haggerly?
Yeah, see, that's how you pronounce it. Because I've got the, you know, his photographs were, you know, released to Life magazine, and I have the cover of that.
They were sold.
You're right. I think he got $50,000 for it. That's what I understand. But anyway, I got a copy of the Life magazine in front of me right now, and it's December 5th, 1969. And I know you've seen those photographs, and they are extremely graphic. But can you talk a little bit about how, you know, these three, at least, you know, just a few people were so instrumental in getting this exposed. And, of course, we all know that once the My Lai massacre was exposed, that it seemed to have a powerful impact on, you know, bringing the Vietnam War to an end.
And I was looking back, I think that was a turning point. And you have to remember, Hugh C. Thompson, and I don't know how many times this has happened throughout history, but not many, I would guess. One man stopping a division-level military operation pretty much by himself.
Yeah.
They were cut from that same cloth, I guess. The people who wrote the letters and well, I don't, not so much the photographs. I still struggle with the imagery of someone taking photographs while people are being murdered right in front of your eyes and not doing anything about it. I wasn't there with them, so I don't know. But as far as the people who stand out, like Hugh Thompson, and then the other side of the coin, the people who committed the atrocities, that gigantic divide between, I guess, moral fiber, if you will, you have to remember that in any large organization, like the military or any other large organization, you're going to have a percentage of people that are not mentally healthy. And sometimes when high-stress situations, when people like that encounter high-stress situations, the worst of them comes out. That could have been what happened at My Lai. I mean, they murdered 500 and some people. Some people say closer to 700 or 800. But they killed the animals. They raped the young girls. They sodomized kids. They
poisoned the well water.
Well, they killed the local monk and threw him down the well with hand grenades. That's not soldiering. That's barbaric.
Can you explain a little bit about what happens when soldiers in a combat situation cross over the line and things become berserk? You know, it's almost like revenge killing. You know, do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, it's fueled by revenge. You two know that.
Yeah.
I mean, I've experienced that myself. After Glenn was killed, I had a vendetta. But the people that I worked with in our gun company, regardless of what happened or how badly you want that revenge, you still find legitimate targets. You just don't go out and indiscriminately kill innocent women and children. You don't do that.
Okay.
Yeah. And what concerns me today is there are people in the Middle East who have been deployed multiple times. They're trying to get some sort of help or relief over there. They end up going to see an army psychiatrist or something, and they're medicating these guys with psychotropic drugs, anti-anxiety drugs. Now, if I remember correctly, in a combat situation, a little anxiety is a good thing to have.
It's pretty normal.
So what the military is doing now with these guys is they're creating a chemical imbalance in the brain and then sending them out on missions.
Yeah.
It doesn't get much stranger than that.
Yeah, I've talked to Iraq vets, medics that did exactly that. You know, when I was in Vietnam, I was giving out some medications that calmed people. Not a whole lot, but just a little bit. But it's interesting, you know, we talk about the Iraq and Afghanistan vets, you know, experiencing multiple tours, multiple deployments in these countries. And one day, I don't know, maybe it was about three or four years ago, I got to thinking about You know, they're experiencing multiple deployments, and what I feel we Vietnam veterans are experiencing is multiple wars. You know, and it just keeps going on and on. You made a comment earlier about, you know, full disclosure. Let's bring out the what happened in Vietnam, and let's try to especially in My Lai, and have the United States make a public apology for what they did over there. And
That was the question Hugh Thompson asked.
Yeah, are
we too big to apologize?
Yes.
And if you're apologizing for accidental civilian casualties in the Middle East, something that was done intentionally, I think, an apology. But you have to face it first, and nobody wants to do that, really.
And it goes back to the Chinese have been wanting the Japanese to apologize to them for the atrocities that they committed during World War II.
And so it turns into a matter of ego.
Yes, it
right,
is.
Right.
Aren't we a little more mature than that? I'm not sure.
The book Kill Anything That Moves by Nick Tersh chronicles the whole intentionality of the war, which the Pentagon Papers back up. Earlier, that there were massacres and massacres and massacres, and it was kind of the policy. My Lai was unique in the sense that it was one unit that did this killing in one day in one village, but that was just an example of what was going on in general around the country. And where I was in the Delta, a 9th Infantry Division, during Operation Speedy Express, I think they killed 11,000 people in a few months, and it was their general was Ewell, this guy Julia Ewell, and he just said, "We got to kill as many as we can." And I just think the whole war, and it doesn't mean that every soldier in the war was doing it, but that the policies of the war, the pattern of the war, was just, it was almost like a genocide.
To be fair, you have to remember that in My Lai, not everyone took part.
Right.
It was 25 or 30 guys.
Out of 100, about 100 or something.
About 120, I think.
So maybe a fourth of them took part.
Yeah, so not every, but the only person who tried to intervene was Hugh.
Right, and with your help, with you and Andriotta's help. I mean, it was quite a threesome. Let's face it.
Yeah, it sure was.
You know, I wrote a note here, and I'm looking at it right now. And it's interesting how, when we think of the My Lai massacre, we think of one other thing, and that's Lieutenant Calley. Everything is about Lieutenant Calley, and he was responsible for the My Lai massacre. And, of course, everything fell on his shoulders, and we all know that a lot of other shoulders got away. Can you talk a little bit about the Hugh Thompson Foundation?
Oh, thank you, yeah. Professor Guy Alkin from the University of Delaware and I worked on putting together the Hugh Thompson Foundation after Hugh's death. It needs some energy. We have a website out there. If you Google HughThompson.org, you'll see the site. But I guess I did it in memory of Hugh, and to not let it be forgotten what he did, also to carry on his pet projects were always helping veterans, so we thought maybe the foundation would have some sort of role in doing that, but it hasn't really taken off much. It's hard to convince people when they're in denial.
Yes.
When did you start that foundation?
Oh gosh, I guess 2006 or 2007.
Uh-huh.
Probably 2007.
Okay.
But we haven't got much of a response. Some people have been wonderful trying to help. Alex Klein, a good friend from San Francisco, has really tried to help us salvage it and keep it up and running. So a few people try really hard to to keep Hugh's memory alive, but most people just really want to forget about Vietnam.
Well, you know, this...
forget about me alive.
This full disclosure event, it's going to be the beginning of a lot of activities over the next few years to counter this Vietnam commemoration, this attempt to glorify the war and give...
Well, how can they possibly glorify the war in Vietnam?
Well, that's what they're going to spend $5 million a year on.
Good luck.
And so I can read to you what Obama feels about it, because I have his statement when he announced the formation of this. There is an event.
I really don't. I don't want to become involved in any kind of politics. I just.
No, but you want to. You want to be. But you want to be a truth teller. That's what you are. And so we need to have a lot of truth tellers communicating to the public about why.
But
this
you're not going to find truth tellers in politics, honest.
No, we're not. No, we're not going. You're right. But we need to go to the American public and saying this is a lot of propaganda you're going to be hearing, and we need to tell you the truth. Now, on June, it was in June of 2012 that Obama announced this Vietnam War commemoration. This was at the Vietnam Wall, and this is what he said. One of the painful chapters in our history was Vietnam, not particularly how we treated our troops who served there. You were often blamed for a war you didn't start when you should have been commended for serving your country with valor. You were sometimes blamed for misdeeds of a few when the honorable service of the many should have been praised. You came home and sometimes were denigrated when you should have been celebrated. It was a national shame, a disgrace that should have never happened. And that's why here today we resolve that that will not happen again. You wrote one of the most extraordinary stories of bravery and integrity in the annals of military history. Even though some Americans turned their back on you, you never turned your back on America. And let's remember all those Vietnam veterans who came back and served again in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. You did not stop serving. May God bless you. May God bless your family. May God bless our men and women in uniform. And may God bless the United States of America. So that's just part of his statement. And so we want to basically tell the truth about what we experienced and how we saw the nature of the entire war. That, and if you read the Pentagon Papers, you know it was deceitful from the very beginning.
Well, I have to say this much. Today I'll stand with the rank and file. The people that concern me in the military today, or that frighten me in the military today, are the general ranks. Please remember that Hugh, Glenn, and I, all of us would have given our lives for those men on the ground. Those were our people, and we were very protective of them. So I have nothing but respect for the men who served honorably in Southeast Asia. We loved those people on the ground. Glenn died for them just a couple of weeks later. We've never had any sort of a vendetta against the men on the ground, only a select few.
When I realized the extent of bombing in the Delta, and then I realized the extent of the bombing all over the country, in South Vietnam especially, in addition to North Vietnam, I went to my commander and I said, you know, these are all war crimes. These villages are all undefended. They're basically farmers and fisher people. And this is basically a policy of genocide. We're just collecting body counts, 5 million of them. And so I said, you know, we invaded this country. So these people are defending themselves from these outsiders. And I didn't know that when I went to Vietnam, but I caught on after a few months. And therefore, if we don't address the illegitimacy of our wars, and concluding Vietnam, we just don't have any cultural material to question these continued wars that go on and on and on and on. We have lots of soldiers that are going to fight in them. They don't have any other options often in their society. And in Vietnam, the Vietnam Wall has about 58,000 names, plus it's 500 feet long. And I've always said that the wall should be long enough to have the slots for all the names of 5 million or 6 million dead Southeast Asians. And if we did that, it would be 9 miles long. That would make a bigger impact.
Well, I think that it's wishful thinking when you talk about full disclosure, because today, to be more topical, why haven't people like Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, George Bush answered the indictments that have been handed down from the world court?
Because we don't have a strong enough anti-war movement among people.
Well, you can't touch them.
You can't what?
You can't touch some of these people in high places. You can't even get close to them. And those are the people that lack conscience. But you can't even get close to them.
Well, then how do we as American people develop a political base that says you can't keep creating these wars? It just makes a lot of money for the military-industrial complex and the war makers, but you're making up lies and pretexts in which to send more and more young men and women off to kill and be killed.
And well, I think what's going to happen is you're going to see the military shrink, and you're going to see more and more private contractors getting into the business of war.
Well, that doesn't get us, that doesn't advance us much.
No, but it turns us into a mercenary army.
Right. Well, I felt I was a mercenary in Vietnam after 4 months. I was protecting the fighter bombers from attack so they could carry out their bombing missions. And after when I saw what the bombing missions were, I said, man, I'm just like a mercenary over here making sure those Vietnamese people die.
Well, how do you put an end to politically motivated wars?
Well, it's got to come from the people, not from the people at the top.
Right. But see, the people will continuously be diverted and kept off balance and kept
distracted,
you know,
for sure.
It works. If you don't comply, your life will become even more difficult.
Well, then we have to then talk about people who have conscience. We've been talking about conscience.
Yeah, I think that's what it boils down to. That, and that's what you need in leadership.
But you also need it in the rank and file people that live in this society. There's got to be some conscience.
Because, you know, this is Mike. We have a very powerful example of what two of you, the two door gunners and Hugh Thompson did. And it came together, what Ridenour did, what the combat photographer did, and it stopped it. That was a very powerful event that you were a part of. You stopped the war machine to a large degree. I mean, everything seemed to change once those photographs came out in Life magazine.
Well, I think a friend of the foundation, Alex Klein, put it best, I think, when he said what Thompson, Andriotta, and Colburn did wasn't heroic at all. It was normal. I absolutely agree with that.
Well, then we need more normal people.
Positions of leadership we need. Mm-hmm. Those.
Yeah, but those people in the leadership are not. They get drunk on their power.
Exactly.
And we, the people at the base, have to build some kind of a capacity to exercise collective conscience that makes it impossible for these people to have their battlegrounds with our men and women that are willing to go off because that's the only subsidized career path the government gives them. It's really immoral.
Oh, absolutely immoral. But what you're up against is the majority of the population of this country believes that in order for us to survive in the world, every other country should fear us.
So yeah, well, it won't work in the end. It's all illusion.
Every empire falls.
You're right, exactly, and ours is going to fall.
I had an interesting experience a few years ago. I was living in the Spokane area for a couple of years. I'm from Portland, Oregon, and the moving wall came to a small town in Idaho, and so I went and saw it, and I noticed something that was written on the top of the wall that really disturbed me. And what was written on the top of the wall was, "The price of freedom is written on the wall." And when I read that, I became extremely angry. And I remember going up to the people that were putting the event on. They had tables there, and people were trying to, find people's names so they could locate them on the moving wall. And I walked up to them, and I said, what's written up there is a lie. I said the entire Vietnam War was a lie. And boy, they had a hard time dealing with me. But I never will forget that when I looked up there and saw that line that said the price of freedom is written on the wall.
Well,
wars make a lot of money for people.
Oh, absolutely they do.
And they do it on because they have a lot of young people that are naive and want to be accepted and recognized in their society, and one way to do it is to go in the military.
Boy, here's an experience I've had in my life. When my son turned 16, he started receiving correspondence from the Marine Corps, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, the Coast Guard. Little mail-outs marketing to minors to win a prize, tell a friend, join the military. I've saved them. I just can't believe that they would go to those lengths to try to bring fresh meat into a situation like this. Well, this is a mailing campaign by the military trying to infatuate young minds that are still developing. Frightening stuff.
The Pentagon has a lot of money in their recruiting budget, and there's a lot of ways they do it.
I hear you. Well, have you seen these ads on television? You're all familiar with the lawyer adverts for bad drug, or if you've been hit by a truck, call me. Now they're marketing to veterans who are being ignored by the VA. In other words, it's come to this. Vets have to hire an attorney to get the benefits that they've earned.
Yes.
Now, it doesn't get too much more disgraceful than that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That 800,000 backlog at the VA, an average of 20 to 25 suicides a day.
Yes.
More suicides than combat deaths. I mean, what does it take to wake the American public up? Must you be hit in the head with a 2x4? You don't see a red flag here. You don't see that you're, after over a decade of war, can't you see what you're doing to your rank and file in the military? You're destroying them.
And we've been in almost constant war since World War II, certainly since the early 80s, and we are in a military society, basically, and if we don't want to continue the wars, we have to rise up against the concept that the United States has a right to go into these other countries. It's also sucking billions of dollars out of our cities and towns and counties and state budgets, because it's all going, the sucking sound of the money going to the war, and the wars are not benefiting us.
No, of course not. And without complete and total disclosure and truth in politics, when you systematically lie to your citizenry on a daily basis, decade after decade after decade, what do you think that you're accomplishing there, other than creating a citizenry that's paranoid, right? Because we don't know what the truth is.
Well, that's why this full
on so many levels.
Yeah, that's why this full disclosure campaign is important.
I mean, it's amazing that not too many people know that since the end of World War II, we've bombed 28 countries. You know, I just made a trip to Palestine in November, and you know, that was quite an experience for me to be around the Israeli soldiers and carrying M16s, and I saw myself in Palestine, you know, as a Vietnam veteran, and it really made things pretty clear for me about, you know, about how easy it is to get sucked in to this military machine, especially now that we have this economic draft.
Hey, Larry, we have to wrap this up.
Okay.
I want to thank you for being on the show, and I want to tell our listeners that we need a lot more normal people like you.
Well, I don't know about that. Is this Brian?
Yeah, this is Brian.
Okay, thanks, Brian and Mike.
Yeah.
Appreciate your time, and good luck with whatever you do.
Good luck to all of us.
Yeah, I just want to tell you that it's a privilege talking to you, and if it wasn't for people like you, Larry, I wouldn't get up in the morning. So thank you.
Well, no credit to me. Just keep Hugh C. Thompson Jr. and Glenn Andreotta in your thoughts. I just happened to be there.
Just happened to be an 18-year-old that was there.
So I stayed in my place, what I was told to do.
Okay. All right. Thanks so much, Larry. It's been a privilege.
All right, gentlemen. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
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 Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's 10 o'clock. Coming up very soon is Air Cascadia. You've been listening to a discussion with Jimmy Tardy, Brian Wilson, and Mike Hasty, speaking with Larry Colburn about the My Lai massacre in Vietnam in 1968. We're going to hear one announcement and then go right to Air Cascadia. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Creative Music Guild's third annual Improvisation Summit of Portland. This year's Improvisation Summit brings together creative and adventurous musicians, dancers, and improvisers for a weekend of diverse and unique performances. Featured artists include Tim